Hello, I'm Gloria Enriquez. This is number 0181, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0181. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Albert Nirenberg, who is a laughologist. And we'll find out what that is, and also the joys of how laughing can be contagious.
When I was in Tanzania, there was even a phenomena of an international laughing epidemic, where basically back in 1962, about three people started laughing in a school in Tanzania, and it spread to the entire school, then it spread to the whole village, until it spread to parts of northern Tanzania and southern Uganda, until 40,000 people were laughing nonstop. It went on for months. And that's something that can happen in Africa. Africa has laughing epidemics. This is a little-known fact. Africa has laughing epidemics quite regularly.
Chris Epting is back on the program with his latest book. This one is called Moonlight Miles, a guide to Rolling Stones landmarks across America, 1964 to 1981.
This really represents kind of the merging of two of my passions, the Rolling Stones and travel and travel writing. I always wanted to write something about the Rolling Stones, something long form. And to me, it's all been done, and I could never think of anything that would be unique or really sort of true to form. And then this hit me, and I thought, gosh, it was under my nose the whole time. Just do what you do and put the Rolling Stones in there. So that's what I set out to do. I've got hundreds of Rolling Stones landmarks all over North America, you know, the States and Canada. They've touched a surprising number of places over the years.
Marty McGibbon is a stand-up comic and the author of Never Give In to Fear, Laughing All the Way Up from Rock Bottom.
This is a good story for anyone to read because it's gripping. This is an exciting story. It's a story that has a lot of hope and inspiration, and parts of it are laugh out loud funny, so I've been told. And, there's romance. I met my ideal mate during the years when I was homeless, chopping firewood into action, living in an abandoned house. And, so, and I met this guy, and I'm still living. We're still together. You know, how beautiful is that?
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0181, was Gloria Enriquez, who is Global Montreal's diva intern. She's been a very busy gal of late working on the new show, Global Morning News, which airs weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. each and every day. So I thank you very much, Gloria, for taking time out of your extremely busy schedule these days to do the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, as he was crossing the street in Seattle, Washington, Carl Gray, age 32, was hit by a Metro bus. Now, the impact was hard enough that the bus's windshield was shattered. The bloody man managed to get up and stagger into a Starbucks store a block away to order a cup of coffee. Employees there called 911, and paramedics declined to let Gray drink the coffee. He was instead hospitalized and is in satisfactory condition. Starbucks employees say Gray was relatively lucid. Well, he couldn't have very well been completely lucid. I mean, he never got his coffee. And wait a minute. This story took place in Seattle, the home of Starbucks. I'm surprised he actually had to stagger a full block to find one. Anyway. Officer Eric Bronson tried to stop James Labonte, age 28, in Madison, Maine, for a traffic violation, but Labonte allegedly sped off, leading police on a high-speed chase to his father's house. There, police say he jumped out of the van before it stopped, leaving his two young children inside. The van crashed into the garage. Bronson chased down Labonte and arrested him. Labonte isn't a particularly experienced driver. As a matter of fact, he's never had a driver's license, according to a police spokesperson. He's only had a permit. Labonte is facing two counts of endangering the welfare of a child, two counts of driving to endanger, and one count each of operating under the influence. Oh, so he was under the influence, too. and he didn't have a license. They never seem to have a license when we do these stories. He was also charged with eluding an officer and refusing to submit to arrest, and also operating with a suspended license. How do you have a suspended license when he never had one in the first place, is what I want to know. Anyway, he was also charged with leaving the scene of an accident. This is a quote from a spokesperson at the police department. Getting in a high-speed chase with an officer, failing to stop, and driving under the influence with the children in the car, that's not a safe environment. Wow. There's an understatement, huh? Yeah. We already got that part on our own, officer. Thank you very much. We understand. Not a safe environment. Moving right along, Rex D. Peterson, Sr., age 54, immediately confessed to pouring gasoline throughout the house, then igniting paper towels, which ignited the gasoline, causing a fire within the dwelling. This according to the Nebraska State Fire Marshal's investigative report after a house fire in Nebraska City. Peterson owns the house, which is near his own home. So why set it alight? Well, he didn't want his son, Rex D. Peterson II, living at the residence any longer. The 29-year-old son and his girlfriend were inside when the fire started, but they managed to escape unharmed. Peterson didn't say why he wanted his son to move out, but he was arrested and charged with first-degree arson and faces up to 50 years in prison. Well, good news, Junior. I think we found you a newly vacant house near the one that was just burnt down. Yeah. Something tells me you're getting Dad's place. Mm-hmm. And a grade schooler in Hampton, Virginia stole money from her father, but he was the one who was arrested. Terrence Newby, age 39, had a pile of money in his house, but when his daughter asked for some so she could patronize the Cary Elementary Holiday store, he refused. Now, according to court documents, the girl's response was to take $40 anyway. Now, when she tried to spend a $20 bill at school, the bill wasn't just filched, it was fake. The principal called the police, who searched the girl's home and found a scanner, copier, some funny money, a gun, and a bulletproof vest. Newby is charged with possessing counterfeit money, but not making it, because authorities are still investigating the origin of the bills. Although I'm pretty sure that the origin of the girl's moral ideas may be easier to trace. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, sheriff's deputies were called to a home in Denver, North Carolina, on a report of shots fired inside. Gary Wayne Erickson, age 46, and by the way, have you noticed most of these felons have a middle name of Wayne? I'm just saying. He admitted firing his 20-gauge shotgun, but he absolutely did not kill the pellet-ridden snake deputies found. I didn't kill him. My snake was already dead, Erickson said. I had to shoot it to get the gas out of him. Then I was going to burn him. Mm-hmm. Erickson also admitted that he was so upset by the snake's death that he shot several holes in the walls and shot up a large cabinet that contains his Dale Earnhardt collection. Erickson is also upset that he has been charged with several counts of felony cruelty to animals, since that might mean the county will take away his cats and his dog. Here's another quote of the day from said Gary Wayne Erickson himself. Me and my wife can't have kids, so the animals are our kids. Wow. Can't have kids, eh? Well, thank heavens for small mercies. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Albert Nirenberg is a journalist, a director, and a laughologist. If you're not quite sure what that last one was, well, we're about to find out. Albert is on the line with us right now from Toronto. Hi, Albert.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. I recently saw a television piece that you did with a local television station here in Montreal talking about laughology. So for those who aren't aware of this, what exactly is laughology?
Well, there's a movie that I made called Laughology, but you might say it is the science of laughter, which sounds like a kind of obvious thing, but there's actually a new emerging science of laughter, because scientists were never really interested in it, you know, until the last 20 years.
Now, if I recall correctly, because I spoke to you at the time, I guess when you were just making this film, when I was doing the old radio show, and you were doing this documentary. But it was more than just that for you, because after doing this documentary, you really got into this, obviously, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. Because, you know, some of my friends have asked me, you know, like, what happened to you? And basically the answer is that when I was doing this Laughology, I had to get trained in these sort of new laughter techniques. One of them was laughter yoga. And I also interviewed a lot of the top scientists in sort of the areas of laughter. And I realized there was something kind of new and exciting going on in laughter. And that so after that, I basically became got into the Laughology kind of thing.
Okay, so from a personal point of view, how has it affected you? How has it changed you?
It completely changed my life. It sounds weird, but I would say this is the best explanation is that I think I used to wake up thinking, you know, the moods that you wake up with are the moods that you get. You can't really affect your emotions. And when I learned about sort of the positive effects of, let's say, laughter exercise or laughercise or laughing more, I realized that you could actually change, you can change yourself to be in happier, more joyful moods, especially if you laugh. And you can laugh by yourself, you can laugh in groups, you can do laughter workshops. You can laugh at the craziness of it all, you know, and so it was really was life changing. And one of the problems I think too is I also worked as a professional journalist, and it's one of the great professions where they describe where it's one of the few professions where it's important to be serious, where people would say, "Are you a serious journalist?" And I think I was a serious journalist. I used to see my job as very serious, and I take myself a little too seriously. And now laughter is seen as really both a kind of psychological antidote to seriousness and an actual real antidote to seriousness, in the sense is now a physical profile for being too serious, that laughter changes in terms of the actual way that your cardiovascular system works. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Now, when I've seen stuff that you've done online or on your website, I think one of the things that often comes up, people say, well, you really can't force it. But I've got a theory, and let me put this out to you and see what you think. It's not a situation where people are forcing laughter. I think it's quite the opposite. I think laughter is natural, and people have learned to repress it.
Well, you're dead right. You are exactly correct. I mean, you said it, basically. That's the issue, is that by our very nature, there's a lot of hard science that shows that human beings are extremely playful animals, and we are naturally very inclined to laugh and have fun. But we live in a civilization that has become extremely serious and has trained us to be overly serious. And that seriousness is everywhere, and we think it's normal, but in fact it's the other way around. And that's what you discover when you start. There's now a movement called the laughter movement, which is, you know, everywhere in the world now. It's only about 15 years old, has a very precise beginning, that is out to sort of change all that, to make people more laughy. But there is some truth. When people say you can't force it, they actually do make sense. What they're actually saying is that you can't. There's a sort of belief that you can't just make yourself laugh on the spot. Well, now there are techniques such as laughter yoga, laughercise, the laughter party. That's what they're about. They're about being able to just make yourself laugh spontaneously for no reason, basically. They're exercise for laughter, and that's the breakthrough, because 20 years ago, these things did not exist. And when I did the documentary, I tried them all. That was sort of my experience. And I realized, wow, there really is something here. And you can force laughter, so to speak, into making yourself laugh quite spontaneously, almost for no reason. And it's fun.
Okay, so when you laugh spontaneously, almost for no reason, how do you prevent other people from thinking you're crazy?
Well, they do sometimes think you're crazy. They do think you're crazy, but that's why you do it in the context of a workshop or something like that. I would say that the way it changes you is that, like, let's say you belong to a laughter yoga club or a laughter yoga group or a laughter, you know, you basically you're just more of a laughter-oriented person after that. And it's not that you then walk around laughing all the time and looking insane. What's more, what happens is that you. So I'm just trying to find a quiet place. It's more that when you next time you get the opportunity to laugh, you really go for it. You find yourself laughing harder and louder than you did before. That's a big difference.
Now, you say this is something that's spreading around the world. Are other parts of the planet more prone to laughter or laugh easily, more easily than other places?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I would say, in terms of the movement, there are places that are bigger and smaller. Canada is actually quite a big country in terms of laughter groups, has a lot of them. And America is pretty big, and then there are places that don't have very many. But they're what's interesting is they're in places you wouldn't expect, like Iran. Apparently Iran has a very powerful laughter club. Beirut has a good one. But the other thing is that there are places in the world where people just laugh more naturally. For example, I would say the continent of Africa. In Africa, when I was in Tanzania, there was even a phenomena of an international laughing epidemic where basically back in 1962, about three people started laughing in a school in Tanzania, and it spread to the entire school, then it spread to the whole village, until it spread to parts of northern Tanzania and southern Uganda, until 40,000 people were laughing nonstop. It went on for months. And that's something that can happen in Africa. Africa has laughing epidemics. This is a little-known fact. Africa has laughing epidemics quite regularly.
Is laughter contagious?
It is absolutely contagious, but the proof was only made in 2006. Some British scientists were actually able to demonstrate that it was actually contagious. But yes, it's powerfully contagious, and apparently it is different from other contagious behaviors. I'll give you an example. You know, if somebody gets angry at you, you might feel angry too, meaning they've kind of infected you with anger. But you don't get angry the same way. If somebody laughs with you and triggers you to laugh, your whole behavior will change. Your breathing, your muscles of your face, your muscles in your mouth will all be triggered into a certain behavior. And that is unique to laughter in that the contagion produces a behavior, which is quite amazing.
You studied laughter not only around the world, but I'm assuming you studied to a certain degree a little bit of the history of laughter. I'm just wondering, as a society, as a group of people, do we laugh more or less than our ancestors did? Or do we know that?
I would say that rural agricultural places laugh more, meaning that was my impression in Tanzania. I could not believe how much people laugh in Tanzania day to day, and they're not in laughter groups. They just laugh a lot. And I also would say, this sounds funny, and I don't mean it in any way, I mean it in a positive way. I find that people of African heritage, black people, often laugh more robustly than white people.
Well, I can concur. There is a guttural African laughter that starts literally in the gut.
Yeah.
And works its way up.
Yeah, well, when I often have to do laughter, I often have to do conferences, or I do speak to large groups, and where I have to get the whole group laughing without telling jokes, and it has to be done quickly and intensely, I'm always very happy to see black faces in the crowd. My joke to myself is, when it comes to laughter, always bet on black.
I like that. I have to remember that one.
Yeah.
People can find out more information by going to the website. I understand there's a website called laughology.info. Is that correct?
Yeah, laughology.info is a film, but also has events as well. We have a few. There's Laughter Size, which is the exercise of laughter. And there's the Laughter Party. That's a new thing we're doing, which is a different style of doing this whole laughing thing.
I know, you know, we often learn things, as the saying goes, from out of the mouths of babes. I sent you earlier today a YouTube video with a laughing baby that is just it's just gone completely viral. To watch a baby laugh, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that is that I totally agree, and part of it is emotional, which is that emotionally we might love babies, but we're actually seeing something, when we watch a baby laughing, we're actually seeing something quite beautiful and amazing, which is, and it's a little known fact, all babies in all civilizations and all cultures laugh at approximately the same age, which is between 2 and 3 months of age. And this is a beautiful laugh, but what it is that it is a universal behavior turning on very suddenly. And What is amazing about it, too, was it's one of the really powerful proofs that human beings are really all fundamentally the same. That Margaret Mead and some other famous anthropologists said, no, fundamental human behaviors vary from culture to culture, race to race. But actually, the universality of laughter is one of the undeniable proofs that we really all are fundamentally the same, and that we have this basic, powerful behavior, contagious behavior, that starts at the exactly same age for just about everybody.
Again, the website is laughology.info. Albert, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. Always a pleasure and a laugh to talk to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Laughologist Albert Nierenberg. Again, you can find out more information by going to the website, laughology.info, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0181, and you'll find the link to the site.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Chris Epting about his book Moonlight Miles, a guide to Rolling Stone landmarks across America, 1964 to 81. And we'll also talk to comic and author Marty McGibbon. She has a book out called Never Give In to Fear. Plus, there is, of course, more Stuff File news and an idiot of the day. We have more Stuff File news for you right here, right now, on a program heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, John Batson, age 62, was stopped at a red light in Hollywood, Florida, with his aunt, age 92, sitting next to him. The bus was behind me, and he just rolled into me, he said. The bus driver was Charles Butler, age 61. And that was just the latest of his 21 bus accidents in the past 11 years. He's had his license suspended 5 times and even gotten in trouble for repeated lateness. But he's still on the road and still getting paid $47,881 a year. After a lawsuit over one of Butler's accidents, Broward County commissioners asked their transit department how it addresses accidents and what it takes for a driver to get fired. The transit department didn't answer. Okay, so the next question. What does it take for a transit chief to get fired? Anyway, China's national legislature passed a law in December to establish that people have a duty to visit their aged parents periodically. China's rapid urbanization has not developed nursing homes and similar facilities to keep pace with the population, and sponsors of the law said it would give the parents a legal right to sue their children for ignoring them. Ooh, is China getting on the litigation bandwagon? Oh my. How progressive. In Dublin, Ireland, inventor David Bonney recently decided to change the marketing of his new shoes to atheist shoes. Now, 2 years ago, he had started a business with the idea of selling Christian shoes that contained water in the sole so that wearers could walk on water. Get it? Yeah. So now he's changed that and he's come out with atheist shoes. So I'm just wondering, does an atheist shoe have a soul? Yeah. Neighborhood observers reported in December that the asbestos removal crew working at a former YWCA in Middleburg Heights, Ohio, consisted merely of volunteer teenagers who are students at the local religious Buckeye Education School. Now, state regulations require that asbestos, known to cause deadly respiratory illnesses, be handled only by certified contractors using hazardous material gear. Buckeye and other officials, while emphasizing that the students were volunteers, yeah, that makes it all right, declined to say who authorized them to work. The people who made this decision, who gets to authorize them not to work? That's what I want to know. In December, the Illinois Times reported that emergency workers were called to Springfield, Illinois, to a church there to rescue Father Tom Donovan, who said that he had been playing with a pair of handcuffs in the rectory and accidentally got stuck. He was also wearing some sort of gag, according to the police report. The church told reporters that Father Donovan immediately went on administrative leave and was unable to answer questions. Well, of course he can't answer questions. He has a gag. And condom company Durex has launched a new app and service in Dubai that discreetly delivers condoms within an hour, with the delivery made by someone dressed as, say, a pizza delivery man or a tourist who slyly slips you the goods without your date noticing. Evening saved. Yes, well, after downloading the app or via the Durex SOX website, users can order condoms between 4 p.m. and 4 a.m. anywhere, anytime within Dubai. The service aims to expand to other countries as well, with Durex launching a Facebook campaign to spread the word. Like SOS Condoms, and your city could be the next to welcome the service, said an ad for the company. Another similar service on a much smaller scale is the Con-Am, a.k.a. Condom Ambulance, at the College of New Jersey, devised by a co-ed to deliver condoms to sexed-up students on campus. Wow. Someone dressed as a pizza delivery man delivering condoms? Sounds like a porn movie plot, doesn't it? Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Chris Epting is a pop culture historian that we love to have on the show. He's had several books out over the years, and his latest one deals with the travels of the Rolling Stones. It's called Moonlight Miles, a guide to Rolling Stones landmarks across America, 1964 to 1981. And Chris joins us via Skype-to-Skype communications from California. Hi, Chris.
Peter, how you been, man?
I'm doing okay. Nice to have you back on the show once again.
Always nice, man. I always enjoy our conversations.
Now, this book, and you have such a variety of books out, but it's always interesting, like some of your previous books, the one with Marilyn Monroe Died Here, for instance, and other titles like that, how you get a sense of history through a travelogue.
Well, that's what I try and do. I'm a really big Rolling Stones fan, so this really represents kind of the merging of two of my passions, the Rolling Stones and travel writing. It was something that, I guess because, you know, they're in the midst of celebrating their 50 years as a band, it just got me thinking about, I always wanted to write something about the Rolling Stones, something long form. And to me, it's all been done, and I could never think of anything that would be unique or really sort of true to form. And then this hit me and I thought, gosh, it was under my nose the whole time. Just do what you do and put the Rolling Stones in there. So that's what I set out to do. And it was really fun. It's only my second ebook too, which is kind of an interesting experience in terms of how you create a book and market a book and all that. But so far, so good. I've got hundreds of Rolling Stones landmarks all over North America, you know, the States and Canada. And it's you know, they've touched a surprising number of places over the years.
Actually, you said it's under your nose. I think it was under your thumb.
Well, that too.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there are over 200 sites that you've documented, and one of the ones that I wasn't aware of, the lake where they posed for an album cover, is the same lake that was used in the Andy Griffith Show?
Yeah, it's amazing. When people see the opening credits of the Andy Griffith right. Show, which is also my favorite TV show ever, they see Andy and Opie walking, of course, down the path by the lake. That wasn't shot in North Carolina. It was shot at Franklin Canyon, adjacent to Beverly Hills out here in California. And it was it's still a very beautiful, you know, little rustic spot where people go hiking. So in 1965, the Rolling Stones went down there and posed for this album cover called Big Hits, High Tides, and Green Grass. And they walked, I mean, they're actually right at the path where the Andy Griffith credits were shot. So it's to me, that's a really fun site because it kind of merges these two great pop culture entities, the Andy Griffith Show and the Stones, in one physical location. It's also the spot where Simon and Garfunkel's album, The Sounds of Silence, was photographed. So it was used a lot back there. They shot, you know, other movies and photos and things like that. But the fact that the Stones were there by my favorite TV show, it makes it very special.
You're such a big Rolling Stones fan, but you're also a stickler for research. So when you finally decided to do this book, what piece of information did you find that even surprised you?
There's one that stands out above the crowd. And this one, I mean, it absolutely blows me away. I wanted to really go beyond just, you know, where concerts were held, where photos were shot. And I knew that the Rolling Stones first dropped acid as part of the Ken Kesey tests, you know, the acid tests, after a show in 1965. And it was in San Jose, and I kind of had a hunch that it was up there. And what I located was the house where the acid test took place, where Keith Richards and Brian Jones first dropped acid. There was a band that played in the house that night. And the house is still there. It's a big, beautiful Victorian house. And within the house that night, as the guys, you know, took their drugs, it was the very first night that a band called The Grateful Dead performed under that name in the very same room. So again, here's this great sort of conflagration of two different events, the Stones dropping acid and The Grateful Dead, who had been called the Warlocks before that, performing under that name for the very first time in the same moment. And I thought that was just incredible. That absolutely blew me away.
It's almost like 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. When you think about things that are that monumental kind of coming together and sort of colliding like that, it really is interesting. And I mean, again, there were other ones as well. There were sort of great little bits of trivia all along the way that I try and incorporate in there. But, you know, the hotel room in Florida where Keith Richards wrote Satisfaction, where he woke up with that riff in his head, is today Scientology headquarters, you know. So, again, just so many bizarre twists and turns with this band. But yeah, that's why it was fun for me, too, because as much as I know about them, when you write a book like this, it pushes you to dig deeper and deeper. And I always come away learning any kind of books like this that I do. I come away, I think, a little bit smarter than I started out in the process.
Speaking of hotel rooms, you also featured the 10th story hotel room where Keith Richards tossed a TV set from?
Yeah, room 1015 at it was formerly called the Hyatt House on Sunset Strip. They called it, the nickname was the Riot House because of all the rock and roll shenanigans that would take place there. But yeah, that was, again, one of the more, I guess, typical rock and roll moments that you might expect. Actually, it was captured on film. The Stones did a documentary in 1972. And the throwing of the TV set out the window was really done for the camera. It wasn't some, you know, natural, spontaneous thing. It was just, it was kind of a stunt to put in the movie. But nevertheless, you see the TV go out the window. The camera goes out the window and you see it, you know, fall to its to its death, 10 stories below.
Mm. Now, you've titled the book Moonlight Miles. Why that particular title?
Well, it's one of my favorite Rolling Stones songs, song of an album called Sticky Fingers. And I just thought I was looking for a name that was sort of evocative of the road and of travel. And so Moonlight Miles, to me, is just such a great romantic title, you know, to kind of set things up. And it was really just that. I loved the song, and it seemed to fit the theme of what I was trying to do.
You mentioned also that some of the events take place up here in Canada where I am. What are some of the things that happened up here?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, ever since the Stones first started coming to North America in the mid-60s, Canada has played a part in their travels. So, you know, in addition to various places they've played, from, you know, the Maple Leaf Gardens to the Forum and all that, you had all the Keith Richards, you know, arrest news in Toronto in 1977, the hotel where he was arrested for drugs, the El Macamba where the Stones played during that time, the various courthouses, you know, that existed where Keith was. So, I mean, there's probably a good couple of dozen just Canadian sites up there. And then, you know, I'm actually doing a follow-up to this book now that picks up from 1981 on. And the Stones have rehearsed up there a lot, too, in the 80s and 90s. So Canada has been very good to them. Not Keith all the time, but again, they love it up there. They've played some great venues there. And so, again, it's fun for me to learn about those things as well.
Are there any of the members of the Rolling Stones or their entourage who are aware of this book? Have you been in contact with them?
You know what? Not that I'm aware of. I do know that they do tend to pay pretty close attention to what gets done about them, as to their publicists. And I've heard tell that it's sort of made it into the pool. You know what I mean? That their people are aware of it, which I certainly hope. And I would love nothing more. I mean, the Stones are not very sentimental. I don't think they sit around and think about and talk about where they've been. But I would hope that if they ever saw this collection, that they would at least think about some fond memories about, you know, what it means to have essentially built their career over here, you know, the amazing places they've played and lived and all that.
Well, there has to be a certain amount of sentimentality amongst them because, I mean, they themselves have put out books, including a picture book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that they're very good at sort of crafting and cultivating their image, you know what I mean? But, you know, whenever you see Mick Jagger interviewed or even Keith Richards, there's very little sort of looking back over their shoulder. I think to their credit, they're very focused on remaining as relevant a band as they can be at their age. And you know, trying to maintain a sense of the now rather than the past.
You alluded to the fact that you're doing a follow-up to this book, and one of my questions was going to be, you never seem to run out of things to write about. So,
well, I mean, you know, to me, the reason I cut it off in 1981 to begin with was that, to me, was sort of the end of the era when the Stones were playing, you know, arenas and, I don't want to say not intimate venues, but more interesting venues. After 81, they didn't tour again over here until 1989. And in that period, they really shifted from being a full-on working rock and roll band into more of a group that would come together every couple of years to do stuff. So they automatically began playing more stadiums and things that, to me, were far less interesting. But then when I looked into it, there still was a lot of... I guess there were some more interesting places than that I guess warrant to me this follow-up. And so I'm just kind of digging into that now. And the response on this one right out of the gate has been really good. That really made me happy, not just among Stone fans, but music fans that enjoy reading about. Like, you never know if the Stones might have played. There's a movie theater. Some guy wrote me from Providence, Rhode Island. And in 64, the Stones played in this movie theater. And he goes there today with his kids. He's a big Stones fan. And he said, you know, I had no idea that where I saw, like, Toy Story 2, the Rolling Stones were up on that little tiny stage. So I think it's good for fans to kind of, you know, relive or at least learn about for the first time where their favorite band has been.
Being such a big Stones fan, I'm assuming you've seen them maybe even more than once.
Yeah, my very first concert in life was June 22nd, 1975. And my friend Roland Ferrier, he's photographer who shot them back then. There's some of his pictures in this collection. He's very generous to let me use them. But that was the night that kind of changed my life. I remember that night so vividly. I was 13 years old, and I was a huge Rolling Stones fan. For a couple of years at that point, I was just completely hypnotized by them. And so seeing them that night was, to me, I couldn't believe, and I still, you know, I think about it, being in the same room with them at that point, I couldn't quite grasp the fact that we were, you know, all breathing the same air. That's why I used to always think of these things, you know. And I've seen them numerous times since then, but nothing, as good as I've seen them since, nothing's ever quite matched the mystique of that first night.
The book is Moonlight Miles, A Guide to Rolling Stones Landmarks Across America, 1964 to 1981. And it's available online, correct, as a Kindle book?
Yeah, it's on Amazon.com, and I think it'll be in another month or so. It'll be available for Nook on Barnes & Noble as well. But and for what it's worth, I don't own a Kindle myself. I haven't quite gone that route yet, but I was pleased to discover that Amazon has a free Kindle previewer. So whether you have one or not, you can download this thing and read the book on your desktop. So you don't necessarily have to have an iPhone or an iPad with the app or an actual Kindle. You can just sort of get this previewer and look at it on your computer as well.
Excellent. Chris, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Peter, thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Chris Epting, author of Moonlight Miles, A Guide to Rolling Stone Landmarks Across America, 1964 to 1981. You can check out Chris's website at chrisepting.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0181, and you'll find links to his site, plus links to amazon.com and amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly for the Kindle. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you heard about the lawyers who sued a fast food chain because their foot-long sandwiches aren't always a foot long? It probably wouldn't surprise you to hear that I think this is a bad use of court time, but I'd like to tell you about a plaintiff lawyer who agrees with me. Ronald Miller is a personal injury lawyer and a member of the American Trial Lawyers Association, a group that often justifies silly lawsuits. Yet, he doesn't like this lawsuit. He says that even though the lawyer suing the restaurant may technically have a case, there are many wrongs out there that do not need the justice system to be righted. Great point, but it's not often that we hear a plaintiff lawyer speak out against a lawsuit like this. So why now? Well, let's be fair. Mr. Miller also says that juries are becoming so fed up with people using lawsuits to solve every grievance that they're becoming skeptical of all plaintiffs. In other words, excessive litigation is now hurting plaintiff lawyers too. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And we're just about out of racetrack with this edition of The Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day and another guest coming up, which we'll talk to in a moment. But first, one more Stuff File news story. Family members of a Pennsylvania man who loved Burger King took his funeral procession through the drive-thru. Linda File, who is one of the three daughters of a West York man by the name of David Keim Jr., who died at the age of 88 on January 20th, said her father enjoyed fast food daily. So the family took his funeral procession through the Burger King drive-thru for one last Whopper Jr. He always lived by his own rules, File said. His version of eating healthy was the lettuce on the Whopper Jr. Margaret Hess, head manager of the Manchester Township Burger King, said the funeral procession ordered 40 of the sandwiches. They also wanted one for the deceased, Hess said. File placed Keim's final Whopper Jr. atop her father's casket before it was buried. Yes, he had it his way. Godspeed, my friend. Godspeed. On to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. Marty McGibbon has probably had more tragedy and drama in her life than most people. She's been to hell and back, but she still maintains her sense of humor. As a matter of fact, she's a stand-up comic. She also has a book out. She's the author of Never Give In to Fear, Laughing All the Way Up from Rock Bottom. Marty joins us on the line right now. Hi, Marty.
Hey.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Where are you right now, by the way?
I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio, USA.
Okay. Now I know you travel here, there, and everywhere, not only doing stand-up, but also talking to people about some of the things you've been through. And you've been through a lot. So before I even get to what you've been through, I want to ask, do you think some of the situations that you have been through, you've been able to get through because you have a sense of humor?
I think so, yeah. Or at least get over. You know, I don't think, I'm laughing now. There were some situations I was in, you know, I wasn't, but yeah, definitely. I think you have to have a sense of humor. And it really helps not to take, at least for me, it really helps not to take myself too seriously.
Now,
anytime I start doing that, then, you know, things go wrong.
I don't even know where to begin. I mean, listing some of the things you've been through, you became entangled in the drug scene, you had a brush with a notorious serial killer, you were trafficked to Tokyo and imprisoned by organized crime, you were brutally beaten, you were homeless at one point. These things only happen in Lifetime movies.
Oh, man. Yeah, but I'm not the Lifetime movie type, I don't think. You know, I mean, I wouldn't say no to one, but I don't know. I'm more than, it'd be more Sundance or, or IFC, but or FX or something like that. I don't, you know, yeah, it is really, there's a lot of drama in my past, and I've come back from it, and that's the reason that I wrote my book, because, you know, I was just thinking, you know, I need to tell this story, because there was a lot of really funny stuff that did happen. I mean, looking back from a clear-eyed present, right? You can look back on all those years, and there's a lot of funny stuff in there. There's a lot of comic relief. But I also wanted to tell about this because I wanted people to know the danger of drugs for certain people. I mean, I'm not saying drugs in themselves are going to hurt anybody. I mean, if there's a pile of cocaine on the table, it's really not hurting anybody. Just sitting there by itself. If there's a pile of cocaine in front of me, there's things that get really bad. I mean, there's a lot of people like me that have had this experience, and there are the families and friends of such people. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to tell my story. And I would read some of these addiction memoirs, which, you know, I kind of like them, but I'd be reading them, and I'd think, you know, that's kind of heavy-handed, you know? And I thought, I just want to write my story, because as a comic, just to go back and tell it and find humor where I can, and just tell a story.
Okay, so I mentioned some of the things. Let's just delve into one or two of them, because, you know, we have, unfortunately, a little time here. But actually escaped while enslaved by the Japanese mob. So the first question is, how did you get enslaved by the Japanese mob?
Well, it was, you know, a really... I thought I was bulletproof. I had this Tonight Show schedule, and I just thought I had, you know, I just thought I was fixed for life. I just thought, oh yeah. And then I got into the drug scene. I was doing too many drugs, and I developed my addiction, began to escalate. And I was in a relationship with this really abusive, handsome sociopath, and he had a terrible temper. And I was just, we were living in my car, no money. I mean, I was just trapped. I was absolutely desperate. And it was a trafficker, and this does happen. I found that later. It's pretty much classic story. But there was an opportunity to go to Japan, and it was an escort service. The lady had, she was sending a girl every month, and she asked me if I wanted to go, and I was desperate enough to do it. And I thought, yeah, it's Japan, you know, and nobody will ever know me. And I can go there and make a little bit of money, and I can just get away from this board. And I'll move to anywhere, and then I'll get off drugs. And that's the kind of thing that drug addicts do. It's just not good thinking, right? So anyway, that's what I did. I went, and I had a one-way ticket. And when I got there, it was the Japanese mafia, and I was a prisoner. And anyway... So I'll spare the audience the grisly details.
How did you get away then?
Well, here's what happened. I thought to myself, just to keep my sanity, eventually, I just thought, you know what? I'm not going to accept what's going on the outside. I'm going to make this the way I want it to be. I just started to get a visual. And I said, you know what? I'm going to be home by Christmas. And this was at the beginning of November. And I thought, that's it, man. And I'm not going to let anything stop me. I'm going to just visualize this, and this is going to be my reality, no matter what happens to me, what happens to my body. I am in charge of what happens to me inside, the real me, right? Because adversity introduces us to ourselves, right? I found my courage. And I just began, I visualized that, and I also allowed myself to treat each person that came in contact with me with respect in spite of what they were doing to me. And that helped me to have my own self, you know. And believe it, I mean, the exact right person came into that place who helped me to escape. I mean, I visualized, I punched a visualization, and he came in there and rescued me. And then when I got back, he gave me the name of somebody to call. When I got back to San Francisco, I called this other young woman that he had rescued 5 years before. He was a smuggler. He's kind of an anti-hero, but really cool. And, you know, he got me out. He bought my freedom. So I was able to get back. And then I was homeless for a little while. That's when the homeless part happened. I just completely fell apart.
So
I couldn't deal with it. I had PTSD.
Let's flash forward. You've now been clean for over 17 years. You're a stand-up comic, but you've written this book, Never Give In to Fear, which, by the way, is an Amazon bestseller. What made you write the book, and what audience were you trying to reach? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people who are not in the situation you were in.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the people that, you know, I just thought this is a good story for anyone to read, because it's gripping. It's, well, if somebody is traumatized by harsh language and street situations, things like that, then it might not be good for that person. I wouldn't want anybody to be traumatized. But pretty much this is an exciting story. It's a story that that has a lot of hope and inspiration, and parts of it are laugh out loud funny, so I've been told. And, you know, there's romance. I met my ideal mate during the year that I was homeless, chopping firewood with an axe and living in an abandoned house and stuff. And I met this guy, and I'm still with him. We're still together. So that's, you know, how beautiful is that? You know, life, even at the very bottom, you know, and even when you're at rock bottom, they're
So basically what you're saying... Basically, what you're saying is if this were a movie, your life is basically the Cinderella story as told by Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, exactly. You're so funny. It's kind of like that. Yeah. If Cinderella wore leather and the pumpkin was a Harley or something, probably. Yeah.
In writing your story.
On the things that transpired in this book. It's okay for me to
In writing your story and putting it down on the page, as it were, in the process of writing this book, was that in itself a cathartic experience? Because I would assume with some of the hardships you've gone through that at some point parts of the brain, just to survive, has to shut down while you're going through this.
Well, I did experience that when I was homeless. I just let go of all the basics and I just went into survival mode. And that happened. But you're asking about the writing process. When I wrote this book, I had been telling these stories on stage. And I'd done a one-woman show in L.A. that ran for, 8 or 10 weeks and got an excellent review in the L.A. Weekly. And I had people like citizens, like upstanding, you know, people that said, I love these stories, they're fantastic, you know, people. And so I just started thinking that maybe a book, maybe. And so I put in the books, the stories that were crowd pleasers, I was able to put those in the book. And then the things with the real tragedy and the scary stuff and the sad stuff, I actually wrote those at the end. Interesting, were the hardest to write. I wrote all the fun stuff first.
Well, we have just
Is that what you're asking about?
Yeah,
I hope
absolutely.
I'm giving you the right.
Absolutely. Well, we have just about a minute, so I'll ask this one question. We've already eliminated the possibility of this being a Lifetime movie, but I did mention Quentin Tarantino. So, would you like to see your story? Would you like to see your story turned into a film?
I would love to have this be a film, and I am going to buy the screenplay software. But if there are any screenwriters out there that want to get a hold of me on this project, definitely get a hold of me.
Well, the book is Never Give Into Fear, Laughing All the Way Up from Rock Bottom. It's written by Marty McGibbon. And by the way, there's a website, nevergiveintofear.com, that people can check out. Marty, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program. And please do keep smiling.
Oh, yes, and you too. And thanks again for a wonderful interview. Thanks for having me on the show. The book is at Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You know, I think it's everywhere.
Marty McGibbon, author of Never Give In to Fear, Laughing All the Way Up from Rock Bottom. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0181, and you'll find links to her site. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Authorities say they discovered a budding marijuana grow operation after residents of a Lincoln, Nebraska house called police to report the theft of marijuana pipes. Officers were called to the house by residents who reported that two people, one of them armed with a handgun, forced their way into the house and took two hookah pipes. Officers questioning the residents noticed marijuana paraphernalia and several bottles of fertilizer. They also saw light shining from under a door barred with a padlock and a power cord snaking into the room. After getting a search warrant, police say they found three marijuana plants, grow lights, and other equipment. Police arrested a 19-year-old man on suspicion of manufacturing marijuana and ticketed his roommates for having marijuana paraphernalia. Okay, if you are robbed of drug paraphernalia, why? Oh, why would you bother to call the cops to report it? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0181. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0181. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, Media Core in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.